Hello and welcome to the We're Not Experts History Podcast. I don't know why I say welcome. I can't imagine anyone listens to it apart from you when you're listening back through it. My name's James, as usual, and with me, as usual, is Sarah, as usual. Hello, Sarah, as usual.
Hello, James, as usual. And can I just say, people do actually listen to the podcast, according to my stats, and those stats, that's not just me listening, because I listen to the file before I upload it, and then I don't listen to it again once it's uploaded. People are listening. It might just be the one person, but...
What's that lie, that saying about lies and statistics?
Sorry? No, honestly, I'm not even lying. I will screenshot the stats and send them to you, because we do have listeners.
But, right, should we get on with it before they tune out?
Yeah, that might be an idea, actually. Go on. No, it's me, isn't it?
I'll be going in.
My God. Okay, so today I'm talking about the workhouse. So I'm sure most of you have heard of a workhouse, but if you haven't, imagine a place where the food's bland, endless chores, no heating. That's a workhouse.
And sounds like my old school.
Yeah, it sounds a bit like mine as well. And they used to have tracing, but I'm talking about my school now, not the workhouse. They used to have tracing paper, not toilet roll. Was that the same for you?
In my infant school, we used to have that, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was just my school, but there you go. Anyway.
Aaron.
So, the workhouse, not school. So, a workhouse was essentially an all-in-one solution for dealing with poverty in Britain from the 1600s right up until the early 1900s. So if you were poor, homeless, unemployed, elderly, sick, or just a bit down on your luck, the government's suggestion was, off you go to the workhouse. Lovely. Yes, but don't pack your slippers just yet, because these were not cosy places. I mean, the clue's in the name, the workhouse. It doesn't sound good, does it? And the idea behind them was very simple. If you really needed the help, you could have it, but you had to really, really need it and want it. And they made it so life inside was deliberately tough, just to stop people turning up for a free meal and a bed and then heading off the next morning.
It was a last resort. It was.
And just to say, the idea behind this episode, just so it didn't end up being too long, in this episode, I will mainly be talking about the history and the idea behind the workhouse, the rise and fall of the workhouse, if you like. The actual workhouse itself, as in what was it like, what was the routines, that will be another episode. So...
Oh, that's another one.
There will be another one, yes. So don't get too excited. So I'm sure you're thinking, if they were so bad, why did they create them? Well, if we go back to Tudor times, so we're going quite a way back, the rich were starting to get a bit twitchy about all these poor people wandering around asking for help. And the solution to that was to set up poor laws. And this was a kind of system where parishes had a responsibility to look after the poor, but not in a way that encouraged them to be lazy. So by the 1800s, things were getting out of hand and expensive, looking after all these people. And the government introduced a new poor law in 1834, which basically said you can get help, but only in the form of hard beds, hard work, and even harder porridge or gruel. Was it gruel? I'm probably not saying it right.
Yeah.
But more about that later. We'll come to that. I'm skipping ahead a bit. But in a nutshell, workhouses were created to be the least appealing form of charity possible. So the help was there, but it came with a side order of cold porridge and hard beds and, yeah, unpleasantness.
Yeah.
So if we think back to the before 1600, the welfare system, there wasn't one. There was no such thing. So if you think workhouses sound bad, imagine if you were unlucky enough to be poor before the 1600s, when Britain didn't have any sort of formal welfare system, at least not the way we think of it today. I mean, today you've got a job centre, you get universal credit, you've got tax credits. You know, there's help there, isn't there? No welfare system in the 1600s or before the 1600s. So who was helping these guys? Because poor people have always existed. They didn't just spring up after 1600. The main one was the church, monasteries. They gave out food and ale and a place to sleep for the poor and the sick. Kind of like medieval food banks, but with stained glass windows. And some of the wealthier landowners, they would occasionally hand out alms, which was coins or bread.
Oh, yeah.
What did I say?
Alms. Alms. Yeah, there's still plenty of old almshouses dotted around.
Mm. Okay. I shall continue. You correct my pronunciation. We make a good team. So this was partly...
You're doing the work and I'm like autocorrect. That's not much of a team.
Yeah. And you do the intro and the outro. It's all right. You can do your topic next time so you can talk and I can listen. So this was partly from Christian duty and partly because having starving peasants cluttering up your land, it was bad for business. It didn't look great. Some villages and parishes, they would help locals if they knew them. But there was no national system. So if you were poor and you lived in a kind-hearted village and you were well thought of, you might be okay. If not, good luck. So a bit like today, poor people were expected to find work if they could. And even back as early as the 1300s, the idea of helping someone that could work but wouldn't work was very unpopular. And in fact, after the Black Death in 1348, when workers were in short supply because everyone had died, well, not everyone, but a lot of people had died, about half the population, the government actually made laws to prevent people from demanding higher wages and to force them to work. So, cheerful stuff. And then in the 1530s, good old Henry VIII, he came along. He went on a bit of a monastery smashing spree, also known as the dissolution of the monasteries. That would be the correct term for it. And in doing so, he accidentally did away with the country's main welfare system. So suddenly there are no more kindly monks handing out food. They've all had to go into hiding. And that leads to a lot more beggars on the street. So there's panic. And by the late 1500s, the government realised that leaving the poor just to wander around starving wasn't a good plan. So they quickly started to pass laws to deal with poverty. So it kind of pushed them into action, really, after they did away with the monasteries. They suddenly thought, oh, we have a problem now. So cue the Elizabethan Poor Law. It was officially known as the Poor Relief Act, but it was a nickname, if you like, was the Elizabethan Poor Law. And it took effect from 1601. And essentially, it was the start of a proper welfare system in England. A welfare system. So what it dictated was that local parishes, so parishes were the smallest unit of local government at the time, they were now responsible for their own poor. So in short, what they did, they introduced a tax system. Here we go, taxes. And the wealthier residents of the parish would pay a poor rate, and this would be used to support people who couldn't work and take care of themselves. And the money was collected by overseers of the poor, and they would decide who got help. So kind of like a Tudor benefits officer, in a sense. Even back then, a bit like today, there was still quite a big distinction between the types of poor. So you have the deserving poor. So those are your elderly, sick, orphans, all of those sorts of things. They were given money, food. Sometimes they'd be given a place to live. These were people that everyone agreed needed to be helped. And then you've got the undeserving poor. And these were able-bodied people who, for various reasons, weren't working. So they would be expected to get a job or be punished for idleness. So if you were healthy but jobless, you may be sent to a house of correction or made to work in exchange for aid, instead of them just willy-nilly handing you out cash and stuff. They would be like, right, either you work for help or you go to the house of correction. Now, a house of correction, just to clarify, it was a place where you'd be sent if the government thought you needed your attitude fixed. Basically. So
why don't they exist anymore?
Yeah. So these were introduced in the late 1500s, and they were early versions of prisons, really. But they weren't really for if you committed like a serious crime. It was more if you were seen as lazy or idle or just up to no good. And you could be sent there for begging without permission, sleeping rough, or just refusing to work. If they felt that you should work and you didn't want to or couldn't or whatever, you could be sent to a house of correction. So the poor lot, it wasn't... Sorry?
That's what I see.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't exactly soft and cuddly, but it was organised. And it meant for the first time, every parish had a duty of care. So it wasn't just about if you happen to live in a nice parish that cared. It was, they had to. They had a duty of care for their own poor. And poverty became a local issue, not just a moral or religious one. And did it work? Well, kind of, yes. It kind of did. It did create a structured system that lasted for over 200 years. Until the Poor Law Amendment Act came along and chucked up a load of workhouses, but we'll talk about that later. So back to the 1700s. So we're in the 1700s now, sorry. So this law, the Poor Law, was passed in 1601. We're now getting to the 1700s. And life's becoming more complicated. The population's growing. Thank you, Industrial Revolution in the making. Things are starting to crack a bit under the strain. So up until now, poor relief's been offered in two ways. So you had your outdoor relief, which was help given to people outside of an institution. So things like money, food, clothing, fuel, like coal and stuff. This was cheaper, easier, and the most popular option. They also had indoor relief, which was given inside what was known as a poorhouse. Now, a poorhouse was actually an early form of workhouse, and they did exist in the 1700s, but they were locally run. They were often quite basic, and they could be anything from a converted barn or even an old cottage. They varied massively. They weren't kind of institutionalized like the later Victorian workhouses that we come to know, but they essentially just aimed to give the poor somewhere to live and work in exchange for help. Now, these were less popular because they were more expensive to run, So they were normally reserved for people that were sick or elderly or had no family support. But despite that, it was, the problem was it was getting quite expensive to feed these people and house them. And the poor rate's increasing and increasing, and the rich are starting to grumble. And because of the Industrial Revolution, which is now starting to take effect, people are starting to move around more. You know, it's becoming easier to move and to travel and to visit different locations. And this system relied on you staying in your parish. So it just became chaos because people are trying to work out who's responsible for who. And they had to pass what were called settlement laws. And that was an attempt to keep costs down. So if you went to if you moved out of your parish, but then you tried to get help, you'd be sent back to where you have come from. They'd say, "Well, we're not helping you. You're not our responsibility."
I was going to say, what's stopping them from going into a richer parish? But obviously, now you've answered that.
Yeah, they couldn't. They would be sent back to where they. I guess in a way, it's the same as now. If you moved, I don't know, up north and you tried to put yourself on the housing register, they would say, well, no, you need to go back to your county and get them to house you. I think you have to live, it's not something I've got much personal experience in, but from helping people previously, you do have to live somewhere for a certain amount of time before you can go onto a housing list. I do know that.
I imagine they'd be counted back, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a similar thing. So the parishes, they try to get a bit creative with experiments and reforms. And as an example, in 1723, there was a new law called the Workhouse Test Act, or it was otherwise known as Knatchbull's Act, and it was named after Sir Edward Knatchbull, who invented it, I imagine. So this gave parishes the power to tell people that if they wanted help, they had to come to the workhouse. And when I say workhouse, I'm talking about the early workhouses, not the big Victorian ones that would come later. Yeah. And the idea of this was to discourage people from seeking relief unless they really needed it. So it was kind of an early form of means testing in a way. And another quite famous attempt, actually, was the Speenhamland system. I don't know where they got that name. But this was in 1795. Yeah. And what they did was, if you were working but not earning enough to support yourself, your local parish could top up your wages, a bit like tax credits, early tax credits. But it wasn't working out. By the end of the 1700s, lots of people, particularly the rich, they were complaining that the system was too lenient. People are taking advantage, people are lazy, these people need to go out and get jobs, and they're relying on the parish rather than working harder. So all this complaining eventually led to the 1834 Poor Law Amendment Act, which is what I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, so the Speenhamland system was named after a meeting held on the 6th of May 1795 in the Pelican Inn, Speenhamland, Berkshire.
Well done.
It is named after a place.
Do you know, I could have Googled that and I just didn't. And I'm glad you did. Well done. So there you go, everyone. Yes, you have. You've contributed. So the 1834 Poor Law Amendment Act. So this was kind of the new, improved, I say that in inverted commas, poor law. So it was, what it was a major overhaul of the way Britain helped its poor. And by helped, what I actually mean by that is make it deliberately unpleasant so people wouldn't ask for help unless they were really desperate. That's basically what happened. So the old patchy parish-based system was replaced with a new, tougher, more centralised system. that become famous for its very strict rules and its grim workhouses. So by the early 1800s, the population's booming because obviously, as we know from previous episodes, if you've tuned in, the Industrial Revolution has happened or is in the process of happening. So population's going crazy. And this messy system that they had in place before, it couldn't keep up. And with all the rich taxpayers moaning, oh, we're not running a charity, government said, okay, we need to tighten things up a bit. So the old parish system was abolished. And instead of each parish running its own system, they were grouped into poor law unions. So each union would have its own central workhouse. They also set up a poor law commission to supervise the system. And outdoor relief was discouraged. So no more handing out money and food and things like that. It was a case of if you want help, you go to the workhouse. And that is your only option if you're desperate. And workhouses were not a walk in the park. We'll cover that in more detail on the next episode. Or I will, and you'll just listen and try not to fall asleep. But it was, they made it deliberately tough and horrible and nasty, so you only went if you were desperate. So the first workhouse that was purpose-built for this, under this new act, it's considered to be the Union Workhouse at Abingdon in Berkshire. Did you mention Berkshire earlier? Was that where that thing was?
Yeah, that's where
the place is. Oh, there you go, coincidence. So that opened in 1835, which was just a year after the Act was passed. So they didn't hang about. As soon as they made this decision, they were off building. And between 1835 and 1840, hundreds of these workhouses were being built across England and Wales. Now, many were designed using, they followed a standardised plan by architects, like one was Sampson Kempthorne, and he created the classic cruciform layout. So it looked a bit like a cross, if you see it on the plans. And that was perfect for separating people, because they used to separate by gender, age and usefulness.
And now, I during lockdown, I stayed in one of these for 5 months.
Really?
Wow! My friend moved down to Devon and was living in one of the in a bungalow that was built in an old workhouse designed like these.
Wow! How exciting!
Maybe it was great. I loved it.
Yeah, I imagine you did. Yeah, well, I know you're much fonder of Devon than you are of Essex, and I don't blame you, to be honest.
Right, not to go that far. I'm very fond of Devon, but it's not Essex.
No, I'd rather live in Devon, I think. I don't know. No, I think I would. I think I would. I do like the countryside. That said, I must say, the main reason I kind of shy away from the Essex countryside is just the sheer cost of living. If money was no object and I could live, I potentially would stay in Essex, but I'd live more out in the country, not in the town.
Yeah. But
because Essex is lovely, I have to say, Essex is really nice. It's got a lot going for it. It's just very expensive.
Yeah, too close to London.
And I kind of think when you look at what you could get for your money if you moved further away, I'd rather move further away and have more for my money.
I'd move Essex.
If I was like a multi-millionaire and I could just, I probably would just stay in Essex because why not? It's nothing wrong with it. It's just expensive. I wouldn't feel the need to run away up north. Otherwise, where will you go on holiday? If you're living in Yorkshire or somewhere, those are the sorts of places I like to go on holiday. But anyway, digress. Workhouse. So, what was I saying? Hundreds of new workhouses are being built across England and Wales. and they're designed like crucifixes. And these workhouses, they weren't like the sort of, I want to say cozy, they probably weren't cozy, but you know, like the cozy parish ones. They were very large, very uniform, and they were designed to enforce strict discipline, hard work, and minimal comfort. They weren't pleasant. Families were separated, diet was uniform, it was basically gruel and that was it, and rules were very rigid. No relief would be given outside of the workhouse unless it was absolutely necessary. So the whole system is designed to discourage reliance on welfare. Was it popular? No, it was not. The passing of the law did cause a lot of unrest, and there were lots of protests and riots, especially in the north of England. And there was a lot of fierce opposition from working class communities, radicals, and even local officials. Some local officials weren't happy about it. So it wasn't just the working class. So we go on to mention a Mr. Dickens, Charles Dickens. Now, he absolutely, for a moment I thought you were serious, he absolutely detested workhouses, hated them, absolutely hated them with a passion. And he had a lot to say about them, and he wasn't afraid to say it either. And he said a lot through his writing. So if you're familiar with the works of Charles Dickens, particularly Oliver Twist is a great example, you'll see his kind of contempt for the workhouse system. Other examples are Bleak House and Hard Times. I mean, I read them years and years ago. I've read a lot of his works, actually, but it's so long ago, I can't remember exactly. But he, in his works, he paints a very grim picture of the workhouse system. And some of the key ideas that he got across were that workhouses were dehumanising, they separated families, they stripped people of their dignity, and they treated poverty like a moral failing. So if you're poor, you fouled, you've disgraced yourself, is what they were trying to enforce. He also felt, or also put across, that the system wasn't designed to help people. It was there to punish. And it was kind of like it was trying to scare people out of asking for help, which, to be honest, it wasn't wrong, because that, in a nutshell, that's what the system was there for. It was so people didn't ask for help because it was so awful. And he was especially angry.
It seemed very weird. They've obviously gone to a lot of expense to come up with these ideas and then build the buildings just to tell people that they don't want to spend any more money, really.
Yeah, it kind of, it doesn't make sense, does it?
No.
It's like, right, we'll make all this available, but we'll make it so awful that you won't want to use it anyway, so it'll just be a fat waste of money. But I'll discuss in the next episode, unfortunately, a lot of people did use the workhouses because they had no choice. Another thing that made Charles Dickens very angry was that children really suffered. Some children would be born in the workhouse system, and they would spend, if not their whole life, their whole childhood in the workhouse. I mean, imagine being born and dying in a workhouse environment and you don't know any different.
Through no fault of their own, they're in these awful places.
Exactly. And his description of the new poor law was a piece of monstrous inhumanity. Pretty much. Why was he so annoyed about it? Well, he did actually have the misfortune. So people think of Charles Dickens, oh, he was a famous author, like he was, you know, he must have been well off. But he did know poverty firsthand. So as a child, his father was sent to a debtor's prison. And a debtor's prison was exactly what it sounds like. It was a prison for people that couldn't pay their debts. Yes, really. You owed money, whether it be rent, unpaid bills, or loan, and you couldn't cough up the funds. The solution, according to the logic of the time, was to lock you up until you could afford it. So this
How are you going to raise the money when you're in prison?
Exactly. That is an obvious question. And the answer is, you can't. And it was a very deeply flawed system. And thankfully, following the passing of the Debtors Act of 1869, it was abolished. But obviously, poor Dickens, he had experience of his father being sent to a debtor's prison when he was a child. So he was forced, as a youngster, to find work in a factory. So he saw firsthand how easily people could fall into poverty through no fault of their own, and how brutal the system was if you were at the bottom, how it wasn't there to help you, it was there to punish you, make it worse. So he went on to write books, but not only that, he became one of the most powerful voices for compassion and reform and social justice. And the workhouse was often in his firing line. He really had a hate on for the workhouse, and I don't blame him, to be quite honest. I really don't. So,
they made some nice buildings.
Sorry?
They made some nice buildings. That's about as much as I can say for them.
Yeah. But, so it, obviously, the workhouse was around for a while, and it had its time, and but eventually it started to die a death, and it didn't vanish in one go. It faded away gradually over decades, like a bad smell. So by the late 19th century, public opinion had begun to turn against the harshness of workhouses. And people were starting to ask awkward questions like, why are we splitting up families? And why are we force feeding porridge to the elderly? So this led to massive public criticism. And Charles Dickens, as I mentioned, he wasn't ashamed to point the finger and in print as well. And many others got on board, campaigners, doctors, religious groups. They started to push for more humane treatment of the poor, particularly children and the elderly. So by the late 1800s and early 1900s, Britain began to introduce new forms of welfare, not just the workhouse, because up until then, the workhouse was your only option, really. If you were poor, you went to the workhouse. And I think I've said that a number of times, but I'm just trying to reiterate how it was that there were no options if you didn't have, if you could not support yourself, you went to the workhouse. That was it.
It's
pretty bad. Like, I mean, obviously, if you were lucky, you might have friendly neighbours or family, but if you did not have that support network, the workhouse was your only option. But I'll cover that in more detail next time. But as I said, by the late 1800s, early 1900s, Britain's beginning to introduce new forms of welfare. So in 1906, we get free school meals, which I was actually quite surprised that this has been around for such a long time, because it always seems like quite a modern thing, free school meals. But 1906, the Education Provision of Meals Act allowed local education authorities to provide free school meals to children in primary school, particularly those that were deemed unable to benefit from education due to lack of food.
Okay.
So, yeah, as early as that. And old age pensions actually came about in 1908. Now, this was a landmark piece of social welfare legislation. And for the first time, those aged over 70 were provided with a state-funded pension. So prior to that, as soon as you stopped working, that was it. And that is why, and I imagine you've probably noticed too, when you look on older census records, and you see, you might see ancestors.
Yeah,
but even when you see ancestors in their 70s still working, this was going to come to an end, because after 1908, people could actually claim a pension for the first time, so they could actually stop working when they were 70 and claim a pension.
And we might have to just do a little explanation for anyone listening in the future. A pension is something you got when you were too old to work.
Yeah, that's basically it. So it used to be 70, and by the time we retire, it either won't exist or it will be, you have to be about 120 to actually claim a pension.
About that. It's just gone up to 70 in Denmark. I imagine we'll be following.
Wow. Yeah, because it did come down. So when it was first introduced, you had to be 70. It did come down. I think at one point it was even 60, and then it went up and up and up. But yeah, is it 70 again now? I lose track. I remember working with a lady, lovely lady, and she must have been sort of mid-60s, and she would always look forward to her retirement, and every time she got to it, they would up it by another year. She'd be like, oh, I've got to wait another year. So I wonder, because I don't think she's 70 yet. So I wonder if she's still waiting. Probably is, bless her.
Yeah, they haven't changed it to 70 yet, but I can see it any moment.
Right, yeah. Well, hopefully she'll get out of there before they change it again. National insurance, that came about in 1911. So that established a national system to protect people against loss of income in case of sickness and unemployment. It's amazing to think that none of these things existed prior to this. So if you wake up with a headache and you think, oh, I can't handle work today, I'm really not well, call in sick, you get sick pay. Back then, your leg could fall off and you'd be like, well, I've got to go to work because I won't get any money. Yeah. So with these new systems in place, fewer people, thankfully, needed to rely on the workhouse. And workhouses kind of began to quietly fade away. Many were turned into hospitals or care homes. Another thing that's quite important to mention is that often you will see, if you're a family history researcher, sometimes you'll see, it's particularly around this time period, sort of early 1900s, you might find an ancestor that's died, and you'll find a record of the death, and it will name the place of death as a workhouse. And you think, oh God, they were in the workhouse. But it may have been that workhouse may have been a hospital or a care home for the elderly, because the role was starting to change. Yeah. It's hard sometimes to differentiate between what was what, but anyway, it's quite interesting. Because they didn't make a big announcement. They didn't announce, okay, workhouses are all being closed down and they're all going to be hospitals now. Or it was just kind of quietly done. So they would just change. They probably didn't even change the wallpaper or anything. They probably just quietly just became a hospital or whatever. So the function was gradually shifting. And by 1929, the Local Government Act, another act, came along, and that officially ended the Poor Law Union Poor Law Unions. So workhouses at this point, they still existed. They didn't just go and demolish them all. That would be a complete waste of resources. But they were renamed things like public assistance institutions, which sounds nicer than workhouse, but it's just a rebrand. But following the Second World War, the National Health Service came along, which is another episode that I plan, because that's very interesting. And once that happened, the workhouse system was finally abolished for good. And former workhouse buildings were either demolished, turned into hospitals, officially turned into hospitals and named and functioning as hospitals, or used for social housing. And a lot of former workhouses still stand today. As classic example earlier, you mentioned that your friend lived in a converted one. So there are a lot still standing, and they're just cleverly disguised as hospitals or council offices or flats. Yeah, they're still there. And some examples, I mean, there are many, but just a couple that I briefly researched. You've got Ripon Union Workhouse, that's in Yorkshire. So that was established in 1776. I don't know if the current building is the same building that was there in 1776, but there has been a workhouse, some form of workhouse on that site since then. But that's actually a museum, so you can go and visit that if you're so inclined.
There's all building.
Yes, it is, isn't it? Do you know what? They actually were, considering they were such... Although they weren't built for a nice purpose, they are lovely looking buildings.
If someone's told you you've got to have this workhouse on your doorstep, you've got to build it. You're not going to build something ugly. It's got to be there. It's an unnecessary evil. You might as well have something that looks quite pleasant.
Yeah, because they kind of look almost like manor houses, but
yeah,
you know, they're quite attractive looking buildings. They just have quite a dark history. You've got Gresson Hall Workhouse in Norfolk. That was established in 1777. And it became a workhouse under the 1834 Poor Law. So I don't think it was a purpose-built workhouse. It became one. I imagine as well there probably would have been a lot of existing buildings that would have been converted, as well as the purpose-built ones. That's also a museum and a working farm. And you can get married there, apparently. So... there you go.
Or was that a hint?
No.
Oh, you're just, already married.
No. Yes, I am. And I would not get married in a workhouse. Definitely not.
No.
And you've got Southwell Workhouse in Nottinghamshire. Now, this
one looks like a prison.
It does. But apparently it's the
if
best...
If you're talking about a prison,
it does look like a prison, doesn't it? It's probably the best, well, what they say, it's the best preserved workhouse in England. And it was constructed in 1824 by a Reverend John Beecher of Southwell. And it was one
he
of
built
the...
that on his own.
Sorry?
He built that on his own. That's quite impressive.
I know. Brick by brick.
Yeah, very clever.
Do you know what? He'd be great at Minecraft. We probably should get him involved.
Go.
Yeah, definitely. I'll hit him up. Okay. This is one of the first, not the first, but it was one of the first workhouses that became part of the nationwide system. And not forgetting Billericay Workhouse in Essex, here in lovely Essex. So this one was built in about 1839, so a bit later. Maybe 1840, and it served as a place of last resort for 25 local parishes, including Basildon. Later, it was converted to St Andrew's Hospital, and the hospital closed in 1998, but it was converted into flats. So it is still there, but it's now flat. So it was a workhouse, then it was a hospital. Now it's flats.
And so if you look at photos of old workhouses, this is one of the more attractive ones as well.
Mm. Yeah, I've actually pulled a photo of it, and it is quite a nice looking building.
It is a lovely looking building.
It is. I love the big sash windows. I love that. Oh, nice. I'd love to live in that.
I've walked past it many times.
Yeah, I've really got a thing for those The Victorian buildings, I have a thing. Do you know, I don't know if I was a Victorian in a past life, but I really have a thing for Victorian buildings. They just seem familiar to me. It's really odd. Even as a young child, I always kind of felt drawn to them. They just felt very familiar. But that said, do you know, I can't remember which, I think it was when we were talking about the Industrial Revolution, and we were talking about the Victorian terraced houses for the middle. So, and I said, I think that the house I lived in Essex, I checked, it was actually built in 1929, so it wasn't Victorian.
She'd been dead for nearly 30 years.
Yes. But it has, from what I remember, it had a lot of similarities. You know, the high ceilings and all of that, but it wasn't actually a Victorian house. It was later. It was practically a 1930s house, which, to be honest, I'd still be all over that. I'd definitely still be all over that. The house I live in now is built in the 70s, and yeah, it just doesn't do anything for me. It's just like a box. But
yeah.
Anyway. Yes, I know. Got a new tap. And what makes it worse is that, and you probably know this, the estate that I live on, it was built on what would have been marshland. So the house actually shifts, it moves. So sometimes you can't open a door because it will stick, and another time it will slam because the house will literally shift. Which I don't know if that's any good for the foundations, but that happens. But that's got nothing to do with what we're talking about today. Just talking about my house.
Poor housing,
So, but there you go. So that was the rise and fall of the workhouse. My plan for the next episode is to talk about what they were actually like. What was it like to enter a workhouse and live in a workhouse? So, yeah, look forward to that. But that's me for today. That's how they came about, and that's how they ended. So, yeah. Any questions? Raise your hands. No? Okay, fine.
No, let's move on. Well, thank you for that. I was going to say I look forward to the next one, but I'm not going to lie to you.
You're rotten. Do you know what? Next time you do, I'm just going to talk and make rude raspberry noises throughout the whole thing. Show my distaste for what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But anyway.
It's much change from copping through them.
Yes. The cough is well and truly done one, I'm happy to say. But yeah. Good. I'll try and get it back just for you.
Anyway, thank you for listening. Please remember, we're not experts, really, really not experts. If you haven't told that, guess that by now, there's something wrong with you. We are two history fans. So we're just waffling about whatever takes our fancy.
Can we say we're two historians? Because it sounds better. Are we historians?
No, we're not. We're definitely history fans. I'm not a historian.
I want to be a historian. Fine.
I think you need qualifications.
Do you? All right, then. History fans it is.